How are you guys? Good?
How are you?
I'm good. Very good. Always good, especially when I come to class. That's the best part of my week. Coming and talking to you guys. Okay. So, does anyone have any questions about anything that was covered on Thursday by Alan McEwen, or any other questions that you need to have raised about anything regarding the class or things that you've learned or anything else? Does anyone have any questions about the film History's Harvest and how it was made, or any comments or anything else? You guys are tired today, Summer? Are you a little tired today? Were you up writing your essay? A couple of people came and didn't even have the assignment at 2 in the morning. I was kind of surprised by that. No questions on that. Okay, let me just explain a couple of things that were in that film that Alan talked about very briefly. There was an old guy who's not such an old guy by the name of Bruce Ames, who is a very distinguished professor at Berkeley. He won the Presidential Science Medal, member of the National Academy of Sciences, and a very famous scientist. And he said that there was more natural pesticides in a cup of coffee than you would eat in almost 1 year. And I thought maybe some of you might be surprised by that. But the fact of the matter is that plants, crops, have no way to fight off pathogens. And the major loss of crops is due to viruses and fungi and bacteria. And plants do not have an immune system like we do. So they don't produce any antibodies that can combat these pathogens because they don't have a circulatory system. They don't have a blood supply, and they don't have antibodies in which one can be able to have an assault on these bacteria. And so the point here is that they have to have some way to fight off these insects and viruses and all these things. And what they've evolved are compounds, toxic compounds, compounds that are toxic to these pathogens, which are called secondary metabolites. Secondary metabolites. And these secondary metabolites are only produced in plants. In other words, you don't produce any of these secondary metabolites. And one of the fascinating things in sequencing the human genome and sequencing plant genomes is that enzymes and biosynthetic pathways that give rise to these secondary metabolites were only found in the plant genome, that is the genes for them, but not found in humans or other mammals or animals. It's a striking difference between animals and plants. And these secondary metabolites are what we call these natural pesticides, quote unquote. And you know these secondary metabolites very, very, very well. I mean, all of you know these secondary metabolites in the form of like perfumes. You know perfumes. These are secondary metabolites that are made in plants, in some cases to attract insects and things to help them reproduce. And you also know secondary metabolites from all those things you can find in health food stores like isoflavones and genistein and all kinds of things that are presumably helpful in terms of antioxidants and anti-cancer-causing agents, which have some good efficacy but not completely. And so these secondary metabolites, many of them, not the isoflavones and not the perfumes and not the attractants for insects, many of these things, when you test them against, let's say, bacteria, or you test them against animals, they're mutagens in high doses. That is, they can induce mutations or cancer. So they're carcinogenic. And generally, mutagenic and carcinogenic chemicals are basically the same. Chemicals that cause mutations have the ability to cause cancer in high doses, in very high doses. And so, for example, when you eat celery, there's these things called sorrelins. I
think it's with an O, I'm pretty sure.
Sorlins, and these sorlins are in celery. They're not enough there to harm you in any way, but if they're present in elevated amounts, they're very carcinogenic. And so the point here is that these secondary metabolites, of which there's thousands of them, and secondary metabolites are unique to specific plants. Brassica, you know, a broccoli will have a specific secondary series of secondary metabolites, and that'll be different than tobacco, which have a different secondary metabolites, like nicotine, secondary metabolite, like caffeine, secondary metabolite, like cocaine, secondary metabolite, all the things that you've heard about. Marijuana, the active ingredients, secondary metabolite, all these things that you're familiar with are generally defense compounds for plants in one way or another, and many of these in high doses are carcinogenic. And the thesis then is that when you eat these foods, which we all do, they all have them, and they have thousands of them, and since all of them are carcinogenic, you're really eating more of these natural pesticides and natural carcinogens than you'd get with synthetic stuff, you know, in 5 years, basically. Although in doses, of course, that are not very harmful for you. In some respects, they can be very helpful, as a matter of fact, in terms of anti-cancer causing agents. I know that's a contradiction, but there's many, many, many different ones. So the key here is that those things are very helpful and very interesting, very different than what we find in animal genomes, and something that we've really learned a lot about from sequencing plant genomes. And they're going to be very helpful in terms of health and all kinds of other things. So that was a business about natural pesticides. Second thing I want to summarize relative to what Alan said at the end of his lecture, and I know that you know, maybe you were following it and maybe you weren't, but the point here is, and this comes up in many of my discussions with many of you at various points in time, and that is that all of these issues, whether they're genetically modified foods or whether they're DNA testing or whether it's stem cells, any of these issues that profoundly affect you and society and everything else have a scientific basis. And what I was trying to hammer in on you and still try and hammer in, and I'll hammer in the entire quarter, and what Alan was saying was that you have to make critical assessments. That's the scientific method. We've been talking about that. In other words, these things are not based on opinion polls. It doesn't matter to me if someone says, oh, organic food is really great for you. That's terrific. I want to know what the evidence is. I want to know what the context is. I want to know what the data says. I want to know where the data was published. I want to know who reviewed the data. I want to know what the specific experiments were. That's how the process works. It doesn't work by an opinion poll, and it doesn't work by anecdotal evidence, and it doesn't work, hey, those tomatoes taste really good, and they're good for me. It works by having very critical scientific studies. And so that's what Alan was saying, and that's very, very, very important in evaluating anything, not just in science, but in anything. Show me the beef. Where's the evidence? But in science, as Alan was saying, and I've said so many times, and I'm just going to keep saying it the entire quarter, beliefs do not count. Beliefs do not count in science. I had a discussion about that for a couple hours till almost 1 a.m. in the morning this morning about beliefs and show me the data. I mean, in science, you have to have data, and you have to be able to carry out experiments. It doesn't matter what the data are. Doesn't matter what the data show. It doesn't even matter if the data shows things that are totally different from what you expect. And in fact, that's good and exciting. But you've got to be able to have data and be able to evaluate those data in terms of making conclusions. And many of this has, and I'm just going to say this, many of this belief stuff, not that there's anything wrong with beliefs, I think beliefs are wonderful, but not in a scientific context. And many of this belief stuff has been polluting, literally, a lot of our science-based thinking, unfortunately. And that leads to a lot of problems and a lot of misconceptions. And so I think one of the major messages that Alan McEwen gave you on Thursday was to not simply accept things, which is what I've been trying to tell you. Don't accept anything, but ask where the data are and what the data show and demand experiments that substantiate some of the claims in anything, whether it's cancer genes or whatever. And I think that that's a major message. Okay, there seems to be a confusion in here, perpetuated, and I don't have any clue how it was perpetuated. This confusion has never arisen before, but I need to clarify it only for the life science kids that are sitting in the class. Only for non-science, it's not really important. There's a class that all life sciences students are required to take. It's called Life Sciences 3, which I have taught. In fact, I taught that class for over 25 years. That is Introduction to Molecular Biology. And it's a lower division course, and one of the courses, Life Sciences 1, Life Sciences 2, Life Sciences 3, Life Sciences 4, all life sciences students are required to take, irrespective of what your major is going to be. If someone takes Honors Collegium 70A, this class, and you sit through this class, which is designed for students who have not had Life Sciences 3 or Life Sciences 4. You can have Life Sciences 1 or 2 because it doesn't impact. But if you haven't had, if you've had Life Sciences 3 or Life Sciences 4, you can't sit in this class because it would be, you know, rather dull, quite so to speak. But if you're an entering life science student and you take HC70A, frankly, you will be so way ahead of the game when you take Life Sciences 3 and 4. Isn't that correct, Gloria? And, I mean, you'll be light years ahead of anybody in that class. So because of that, and because I'm a really big believer that students shouldn't sit through classes in which they learn the same things over and over and over again, I petitioned the life sciences people who are in charge of this stuff, and I said, students that come through HC70A, which is this class, and if they take the laboratory class for the spring quarter, frankly, will have more molecular biology than most seniors who are majoring in molecular cell and developmental biology in terms of knowledge. Is that true, Mike?
I would agree with that.
And so why should they sit through Life Sciences 3? And so the rule is that if you've taken HC70A and HC70AL, you can petition to opt out of Life Sciences 3. That's what the rule is. And if you're an MCDB major, you can petition to opt out of Life Sciences 3, and you can petition to opt out of MCDB 106, or what is that thing? 104, which is the laboratory. And so by taking HC70A and AL, which are very intense, as you know, and AL is just as intense, you can opt out of a number of requirements because we don't want you to have to go through any redundancy. I don't know where the misconceptions came in. It certainly didn't come from me or from Jessica or from anybody in the life sciences core, but sometimes things get translated in the wrong way. But I just wanted to sort that out. And if you have any counselors that are confused, please have them call me and we can sort all that out. But I can say that all the professors and all the department chairs and everyone who counts knows what's going on. Correct, Jessica? And there's really no confusion among faculty or administrators. Enough said. Thursday, we're going to have a guest lecture by Dr. Richard Hamilton, who I know very, very, very well, a good friend of mine. He's the CEO of a plant genomics company in Thousand Oaks, which I helped to found about 10 years ago. And he's going to talk about how to make a biotech company. I'm not going to tell you that much about Richard now, except that he has a very unique background. He's a molecular biologist with a business background, who is also a venture capitalist, started many companies, and now is a chief science officer of a very exciting company. And I had him scratch out a case study for you. And he did a really clever job, actually. He used a little bit of his business school speak. And this is a case study called Decisions, Decisions, and Decisions. And the format of Thursday lecture will be, he will give a lecture telling you how you start a company and where you get the money from and how you go about getting the money and how you protect your technology. It's fascinating stuff for those of you who are thinking going into business or anything related to biotechnology. And he's a really, really unique guy, very unique guy. And Then after his lecture, he will use the Socratic method and talk to you about this case study, so you should read it because you're going to be asked questions about it. Not questions like, you know, what was in the case study. It's going to be questions like, how do you start your company? Where would you get your money from? Where would you go? What would you do? How would you protect your technology? All of which is centered around this case study. And for those of you that are planning on going to business school, this is exactly how it's done. You go through case studies and you discuss them and have questions, and this is the format. Then those of you that are going to dinner, Richard can't go to dinner because he's having a dinner with the Assistant Secretary of State who's in town on some biotechnology energy issues, and so you guys will be going to dinner with me, but there will be a reception for him. Then on next Tuesday, which was supposed to be on Thursday, but I've been really scrambling. I should say Jessica's been scrambling because all of our speakers have been changing their schedules overnight, things that we had organized a long time ago. They're switching on us for a variety of reasons. We're going to have Officer Harry Klan here on Tuesday. He was supposed to be here a week from Thursday, but there was a conflict, so he's coming on Tuesday. And he is the chief DNA criminologist for the Los Angeles Crime Lab. And he's been involved in every high-profile DNA case, even including O.J. Simpson, going back over a decade. And there's nothing that he doesn't know about this. And, you know, he's a field guy, too. And so I'm warning you that there's going to be some pretty gruesome pictures that he's going to show on Tuesday. I mean, this is the real stuff. This isn't like CSI. This is the real McCoy that you're going to be seeing. And so he'll be talking to you about using DNA in the law. He'll be talking to you about Los Angeles Crime Lab, talking to you about a bunch of things. And he's a very, 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 well, he's a terrific guy. And he's also a graduate of UCLA microbiology department. And so he's agreed to give up his time. All these speakers really are taking a whole day, but it's more than that. To prepare, it takes a lot of time because, as all of you know, these people, except for Alan, they don't do things like this, so this is really something quite different. And again, Harry's running out, but we're going to have reception for him, and then there'll be a dinner on Tuesday instead of next Thursday with me, okay, at the Faculty Center. So again, who's Richard Hamilton? Just again, briefly, he's the chief executive officer, the CEO of Cirrus, Inc., this is a company that I started with two other people. I was the science founder, and two others were the business people. We started it with $300. I put in $100 of my own money. The other two people put in $100, but then subsequently millions after that. And this was started 10 years ago. And just as a disclaimer, I'm on the board of directors, but I don't really have very much else to do with the company other than go to board of directors meetings. But I did spend 2.5 years of my life starting this company and providing the original science vision for this company, which is completely different now than when it was 10 years ago. In any case, Richard has a PhD in molecular biology from Vanderbilt University. He was a Howard Hughes postdoctoral fellow at Harvard for a couple of years. He decided that he didn't want to go into science, and he left science and he got a job with a venture capital firm called Oxford Biosciences. Oxford Biosciences started half of the human genome companies you read about in the article called Human Genome Gold that you read a few weeks ago for your discussion. They were the venture capital firm. Richard worked for that, was involved in starting many of these different companies. Oxford Biosciences was one of the founders of Cirrus, put in quite a few millions of dollars in helping the company get going, along with a couple of other people. And he moved up from the chief financial officer to the chief executive officer. But he's also unique because there's an organization called BIO, which is the organization of all biotechnology companies that come together in a big meeting every single year and do a lot of really terrific stuff. And he was the chairman of the agriculture section of that particular organization. And so, I mean, he really knows just about everybody that you can imagine in biotech, but he's a very smart young guy, about 40, 41. So he has a PhD in molecular biology, but he also has a very strong business background, which is very unique. And I think you're going to find him to could be very entertaining. Again, Harry Klan, I just told you about. Daisy, I see your hand. Harry Klan, who I've told you about, he's a graduate of UCLA, undergraduate, and he also is this DNA technical leader, but I just want to point out that he also, and I'm going to point this out next week again, that he's won many citations by the Los Angeles Police Department. Okay. Now, Daisy, I won't forget you, I promise. Discussion articles for tomorrow. So tomorrow we're going to talk about, in discussion, DNA testing. In fact, we're going to talk about DNA testing in discussion for a few weeks. Next week you'll have a little bit of a buy-on discussion, which I'll talk about on Thursday. But you'll be talking about DNA testing in humans, which is going to be a subject of a lot of discussion in this class. And so the articles are chromosome mapping, very difficult article if you've looked at it. It's very complicated, it's very poorly written, it's very convoluted, but there's a couple messages there, and I think that you'll be able to sort them out. Please read your book, chapters 8 and 11. In particular, I want you to know figures 8.1, 8.2, 8.3, 8.4, 11.2, 11.4, table 11.1, and a box called "And You Decide," which has ethical issues in DNA testing. And that'll help you with the articles that you're reading, particularly chromosome mapping with DNA markers. Then there's going to be a discussion on that. And in reality, look at chapters 8 and 11, because you'll need those for tomorrow's discussion, next week's discussion, and a discussion the week after when you go to the courtroom and you have a little trial that you're going to do in the law school. I also have some articles for you that will be very helpful and that Mike and Gloria will be alluding to tomorrow, and that is a March of Dimes study that just came out today that is shocking. 8 million children are born with genetic defects every year, of which 80 to 90% of them are preventable. Think about that. Preventable. With better DNA testing, with better genetic counseling, with a lot better prenatal care for women. A lot of it is education and other kinds of things, but we're talking about 8 million birth defects every single year, of which 80% of them are preventable. That's quite an amazing statistic. And so I gave you a copy. Just hold your questions for me, please. I gave you a copy of that report, just a summary, which you should look over. And then there was an amazing article in the February issue of Discover magazine, which those of you, if you don't read it, you ought to just pick up Discover every month because it's got a lot of great stuff in it. And this is exactly what you're going to be talking about in discussion tomorrow. Exactly. How do you find a disease gene when you don't know anything about the gene? That's exactly what you're going to be talking about in discussion. And this has to do with baldness in women, which is a very, very, very psychologically debilitating disease that affects young girls at age 12 and 13, and they completely lose their hair because their hair follicles are destroyed. They lose all their hair, not just on their head, eyebrows, everywhere. And that's a genetic disease, and it runs in certain populations. And a very, very, very fascinating woman who's a professor at Columbia marched and found some of these genes using methods not that different from what you're reading about for your discussion tomorrow. And so I thought that this was a really terrific real-life story. There's really no science in there, so to speak. It's just a really neat real-life story of how DNA testing and searching for genes really is important because it has real-life impacts on real people. And why did this woman go after the gene? Why did this professor at Columbia? Because she has that disease. And she made that her life's work because she was afflicted by that particular disease. And she's a molecular biologist, a geneticist, and she's had some incredible successes, as you will read. And then I threw in another Scientific American article that you can just scan, but it's of a new DNA sequencing technology. And the reason I threw it in the hopper is because this will make everything that you're reading for tomorrow's discussion obsolete within 10 years. Because this is a new way to sequence with a new machine in which you can sequence 20 to 40 million bases of DNA per hour. Per hour. I mean, that's more than anyone could even dream of 5 years ago. And what that technology is going to do is going to make it possible for you to go to any DNA testing unit, give them some of your white blood cells, get them to get some of your DNA, and they're going to be able to sequence everybody's individual genome, which means DNA testing, the way you're reading about it for tomorrow, will be completely outdated. And so this is very futuristic stuff in this article. And I'm not interested in you learning all the technology because it's very complicated technologically, but just read it in terms of what the prospects are going to be a decade from now. And it's very, very, very exciting and leads to all kinds of social and ethical and incredible issues because you'll know every allele you have in your genome. And everybody in this room will be able to know what their alleles are different from anybody else's. All of them, not just one or two or five or ten, every one of them. And so that leads to all kinds of new issues and exciting things, but scary things. Towards the end of this class, we will be DNA fingerprinting all of you. And I mean that, literally. Not a thumbprint. You're going to be fingerprinted using DNA markers. I'm not going to say very much more about that, except you'll see how it operates when we bring in all the paraphernalia. Mike and Gloria and a few others are going to be scrambling tonight and tomorrow to do all the molecular analysis. It does take a lot of time. But the point is that we're not using any gene. In fact, we're not using a gene at all. We're just using some random marker that has no genetic basis. It's completely random. So if any of you are concerned that we'll know whether you have you're a carrier for this and for that and for that, we're not doing anything. This is completely innocuous, non-gene DNA that we're using. That's the main marker used in DNA testing in the law in a variety of things. So I'll tell you a little bit more about that when I give you the results. Okay, Daisy, you had a question.
Oh, I was going to say, where can we access the case study?
Pardon?
Where can we get the case study to read for Robert Hamilton?
I said we were going to hand it out
Okay.
at the end of class. Question, Shauna.
I'm sure this is probably answered in the article, but the March of Dimes figure that you gave 8 million people, where was that from industrialized countries?
I did not say people. I said children.
I'm sorry. Children. 8 million children born per year in industrialized countries? Or
no, worldwide.
Worldwide. Okay.
Do you know what the March of Dimes is?
I know that it's not, is it a pediatric?
Have you ever heard of March of Dimes?
I've heard of them. They send us stuff in the mail.
Tell me what it is.
I know that it's a foundation, nonprofit, private, that I think it funds children's medical research. I don't know if it has any like specific causes that it benefits, but.
How many of you heard of the March of Dimes? What's the March of Dimes most famous for, Charles?
Isn't it like?
Go ahead. Like? It's not like anything, but it is something.
I don't know. I just, for some reason, I remember, like, in school, you'd put coins in the box, and then, like, it raised, like, if you...
Not like. Eliminate that from your vocabulary, please.
If you put coins in the box...
Thank you.
No. If you put coins in the box, you get points for your team. And if,
yeah, so they do fundraisers. It's private.
Yeah.
Are you from Detroit?
No.
You like the Tigers?
I like the hat.
You like the hat. Okay. What's the March of Dimes most famous for? Does anyone know? It's a real generation gap here, and I'm glad that you don't know, truthfully.
Was it for working on the vaccine for polio?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm glad that you don't know. Because when I was a child in the early 50s, when spring came along and we were in elementary school, we weren't allowed to go outside or go to school because of a very, very, very serious disease called polio, of which there was absolutely no cure, of which struck children mercilessly. And I mean mercilessly. I cannot tell you how many of my little classmates got polio. And what that meant was that at some times, in very severe cases, they weren't able to breathe anymore, and they had to be in these iron lungs that would breathe for them. And they really were debilitated for life. crippled for life because it's a very severe neurodegenerative disease due to a virus, the polio virus. And so the March of Dimes used to be called the Mother's March of Dimes. When I was a little kid, we would go from door to door with our parents, and we would ask for dimes. And we would collect these dimes, and then we would send them to the March of Dimes Foundation. And they funded a guy by the name of Jonas Salk, who discovered the polio vaccine, of which it came out in the early 50s. Everyone got vaccinated for polio. Of course, no one had been vaccinated before. And I can remember very vividly standing in line for about 4 hours in front of my elementary school getting a polio vaccination shot. And that was something which was a revolution. And in fact, there's very few cases of polio in the world today. It's almost been completely eradicated because of the polio vaccine. And all of that was done and funded by the March of Dimes. It used to be called the Mother's March of Dimes. Marching in neighborhood for dimes in order to fund this foundation to find a cure or a vaccine for polio. And that's a real tremendous success story. Any other questions? Nick.
Hey, just as a follow-up, I just want to know what year it was that they discovered the vaccine?
It was when the vaccine was made, so it wasn't really discovered. They had to make it and then purify it. This is 52, 53, 54, long time ago. Long time ago. Any other questions? Yuditha, you have a question? You sure? Got a smile on your face? Missed you last week. You and Jordan and playing hooky or something, huh? Yeah, okay. You feeling good now? Yeah. Okay, great. Let me pick up where we started off last lecture. Just review a little bit of what we talked about to gain some continuity here. We talked about the properties of a gene, and we went over that in quite some detail. And you'll see that next Tuesday again, I think, when you get your take-home exam handed out next Tuesday. You'll have your take-home exam. We talked about a little bit about the evidence for genes being in the nucleus, and that very famous experiment with the algae, that Hamerling experiment. We talked about the evidence that genes are in all the genes required to program the development of an organism. I'm going to come back to that today. Are present in the nucleus of a frog cell. And we talked about the origins of cloning. But the concept was that no matter how specialized the cell is, it contains all the genes that are required to program the entire development of that cell. And then we talked about this really, really important and groundbreaking experiment that Griffith did, and then Avery et al. Picked up on what is the genetic material, and that showed that it was DNA was a genetic material. But more than that, what we talked about last time was me getting you to think about how to design experiments, how to think about experiments, and again, how to think critically. What are the alternative explanations? What is the unambiguous experiment that has to be done? What's the critical experiment? Do you accept that evidence or do you not accept that evidence? What's wrong with that experiment? Or what could be done to show that an experiment has a little bit, let's say, stronger conclusion, so to speak? And so out of all of these experiments, clearly, that thinking process is really the most important thing I'm trying to teach you. But in that experiment last week, it was the origin of genetic engineering, clearly from a very, very interesting point of view. And so what I was talking about, I'll never get that, what I was talking about was the Avery experiment. And that Avery experiment simply went like that, and that was that there was this transforming principle. And the transforming principle was something that had been discovered by Griffith. And Griffith really didn't know what that transforming principle was. And I'm not going to go into what it is again, but I think you got the gist of the idea. And then what Avery did was to show that the transforming principle was, in fact, DNA. In other words, that they could transform these virulent, these non-virulent rough cells into virulent smooth cells simply by using smooth DNA. And the critical experiment of that experiment was to show that when you use an enzyme, and we talked about this in class, that was specific for DNA and only DNA and specific for degrading the phosphodiester bonds of DNA, that that enzyme called deoxyribonuclease, DNase, destroyed the transforming principle. And enzymes that were specific for RNA or protein or lipids or carbohydrates did not destroy the transforming principle. And that was the critical experiment that really showed beyond a shadow of a doubt, specific molecule, specific enzyme for that molecule, that enzyme destroyed the transforming principle, no transformation, showed beyond a shadow of a doubt that DNA was in fact the genetic material. And I said that it showed that DNA was the genetic material because the predictions of DNA being the genetic material were satisfied. That is, the smooth DNA could transform the rough cells into smooth. And once those rough cells were transformed into smooth, it was forever. And so that meant that the DNA could confer a new phenotype to the rough cells. It could change them from rough to smooth. That's the phenotype. So that directs the production of something that would change that phenotype. But I also said that it fulfilled those predictions because the smooth was able to replicate from generation to generation, and a property of the genetic material was to be able to replicate. Now, the exact same experiment is the basis of everything that we've been talking about with respect to genetic engineering. In other words, as we've said many times, when genetic engineering was invented in 1973 by the experiment that you read about in your first discussion by Stanley Cohn and Herbert Boyer, that was simply a transformation experiment, in essence, and not that different from what Griffith and Avery had done, only it was more directed rather than, in other words, they knew what they were doing other than simply using this random DNA population from smooth and rough bacteria. And in this case, they took this plasmid PSC101, and it had an antibiotic resistance gene. They transformed, using the term that Griffith invented around the turn of the century, they transformed these E. coli cells that were not resistant to antibiotic. And again, antibiotics are not antibodies. Antibodies are the things in your blood cell that combat viruses, like the antibodies to polio. Those are the basis of vaccines, antibodies. Antibiotics are made by living cells, such as mold, penicillin. Penicillin is a mold. That's where the name penicillin comes from. And they're secreted by these molds in order to fight off bacteria that might want to destroy the mold. So it's antibiotic, not antibody. They're very different than from my discussions this week with a couple of you. That still seems to be confusing. In any case, we have an antibiotic resistance gene. They're on plasmids, as you know. And you transform an antibiotic-sensitive bacteria, and the DNA enters. The plasmid enters, as you know, from your quizzes and everything. That plasmid can replicate, and we now change the phenotype of that particular cell from antibiotic-sensitive to antibiotic-resistant. And that means that the DNA is able to replicate, meaning the plasmid replicates, because all cells subsequently are antibiotic resistant. And furthermore, a phenotype is produced. Antibiotic sensitivity goes to antibiotic resistance. That means that that gene on that plasmid is able to direct the production of something, which it does, an enzyme. And that enzyme is able to, in a sense, detoxify antibiotics. That's one way in which they work. And so then the cell is antibiotic resistant. And that's a transformation experiment. And as I also talked about, we have transformation experiments in higher organisms where you take a naked piece of DNA, like the glowfish DNA or any other DNA, you inject it into an egg and whatever. You've talked about this in discussion now, and you get the transformation of something into a super mouse or a mouse that is green or a pig that's green or a mouse that can produce a drug or a pig that can produce a drug, whatever. That, again, is a transformation experiment. Again, in the word is used, transformation. So all this drives back to Griffith. But it also shows, as we've discussed, evidence for DNA being the genetic material. And what it shows is, in essence, picking up on where I left off, it shows that what genetic engineering is simply a transformation process. That's all genetic engineering is, scientifically and mechanistically. All it is working with DNA and working with the principles in a cell, getting a piece of DNA, a gene or whatever, into a foreign cell, that is a cell in which that piece of DNA doesn't reside. That piece of DNA gets into that cell by some mechanism, a particle gun, agrobacterium, microinjection, transformation with calcium chloride, variety of different procedures, gets into that target cell, and the crux of it is that it uses the cellular machinery, the machinery of that cell, to replicate it and to express whatever gene it contains, that is, to produce a particular phenotype. And so it's the machinery in the cell that's allowing this stuff to happen. In other words, the foreign DNA gets into the cell and uses this machinery of the cell that we're going to talk about in a few minutes to replicate itself and to express the gene and make a protein and change the phenotype. That's what the word transformation means, changing the phenotype. Antibiotic sensitive to antibiotic resistant. Normal size mouse to super mouse. Non-glowing mouse to a green mouse. Okay? A sheep that doesn't produce a drug in the mammary gland transformed into a sheep that now can produce, you know, some factor 9 or factor 8 or some drug in the mammary gland. And it does it because the naked piece of DNA, whether it's smooth DNA, glowfish DNA, whatever the DNA is, gets incorporated into the chromosome of that organism. That's what happened. The DNA goes into the cell and it gets right incorporated into the chromosome. And because it's incorporated into the chromosome, it says the DNA has the same structure as the DNA in the chromosome of that cell, and it also says that that DNA then is replicated along with the machinery of replication of that cell. So it gets in there, it gets incorporated without going into mechanism, and it gets replicated, and that means that the cell has been genetically transformed. Once that piece of DNA is there, it's there forever and replicated along with all the other genes and DNA in that target cell, and then it makes and changes the phenotype. And it also means that you can use any piece of DNA, any combination of DNA, you can synthesize these genes, as we've talked about many times, you can do anything. And I'm going to show you a very spectacular result in a few minutes. You okay, Kyle? I can show you some very spectacular results that are going to have your eyes popping open in about 30 minutes, in which everything that I've shown you about genetic engineering so far is nursery school stuff compared to what I'm going to show you in about 30 minutes. And so it'll show you how you can use this stuff to transform organisms in a variety of different ways. Okay. Daisy, do you have any questions? Kyle? Loda? Jordan? Happy? Everyone's happy? Hannah, any questions? Chris? Easter? Jim? Questions? Sommer? David? Getting to know your names, huh? Okay, let me move forward. Let's talk about something that we've talked about the entire quarter, but in essence, you know a little bit about, but you don't know very much about. So let's talk about genes. Again, the subject of this whole dissertation that I'm giving you is, what are genes? I've just given you the evidence that DNA is the substance of what genes are made of. We haven't really talked anything about what genes are from a chemical point of view. I mean, you know that from reading your double helix and everything else, but you've never heard it the way Bob Goldberg talks about what genes are all about. And that's what I'm going to tell you about. And what I have to say is pretty important. It'll be a review, but some of it's going to be new in a different context because it's going to frame everything that you need to know probably for the entire quarter. So there's a picture of genes. That's That's a series of genes. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I can see 10 genes, 10 individual genes in that electron micrograph. And I can see the beginning of a gene, and I can see the end of the gene very nicely. And I can draw a picture of what I'm looking at under the microscope, and there it is. I can see the beginning, and I can see the end. And I can see something that looks very nicely, what they call a Christmas tree. And so what you're looking at is genes in action. And what you're looking at is genes in the process of making RNA. And those little Christmas tree things, you're visualizing the RNA being made, being copied off of the gene. And the first thing that you can see is that, one, there are a bunch of genes that are next to each other. That's very important. The second thing you can see is there's space between these genes. Notice that there's a space right over here. Better use the pointer because I think it's easier for you. There's a space right over here, and there's a number of genes that are next to each other because I just counted them. And so what this says is that I can see the beginning of a gene, I can see the end of a gene, I can see a space between this gene and the next gene. Here's the beginning of a gene, and here's the end of another gene, and here's the beginning of this gene, the end of another gene, and so on and so forth. Uditha.
The dark masses we're seeing are genes, and then the genes are made of DNA? I'm confused as to what those...
You're asking me the genes are made of DNA, or you're telling me?
I'm asking. I don't...
You don't know that genes are made of DNA?
I understand. I don't understand. I understand the...
Ask a question.
Okay. DNA...
You're giving me a statement. Ask a question.
Okay. I'm trying to think of how to make it a question.
I'm staring right at you.
I know you are.
Making you nervous.
Yes, you are.
I know. You know that genes are made of DNA. We're not going to start off that question like that, so go from there.
Where are these genes?
Where are they? They're on a little grid being looked at in an electron microscope in a laboratory.
Where would they be in my body?
Where
in the nucleus?
Where do you think that they'd be? Well, you tell me. I'm not going to answer that question. I refuse to answer that question.
I think they're in the nucleus
of
my cell.
You think, or do you know?
I know they're in the nucleus of my cell.
Okay, you just answered your own question.
Are they just floating around like that?
Well, you're looking, how would an experiment on genes be carried out? You did one in class about 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
Did you look at the genes in your body, or did you look at your own genes?
I don't know.
Sure you do. It's not good enough. Can't say I don't know in this class. What did you do the first day of class?
We looked at DNA.
How did you look at it?
We mixed it in that solution and pulled
so
the goo out.
So it wasn't in your cells, was it?
No.
So you isolated it.
Yes.
So in order to look at genes, you'd have to isolate the genes.
Yes.
So what are you looking at here?
Isolated genes.
Yeah, it isn't in your cells. So we're looking at isolated genes under an electron microscope.
Okay.
But we're looking at genes in action here. We're not just looking at naked DNA. We're looking at genes in action.
Okay.
So we've done an experiment here. So you know the answers to these questions. So we have a gene, we have the beginning, and we have an end. How do I know what the beginning and the end is, Heather? How can I just point to this? I'm just pointing it, saying, here's the beginning and here's the end. Here's the beginning and here's the end. How do I know that? Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think?
Well, my guess would be...
Don't guess. Your hypothesis is...
My hypothesis is that it has something to do with the, I guess, transcription, I guess you would call it, like where it's beginning and where it's ending.
Okay, so how can I know that this is the beginning and that's the end? What do you see? Describe what you see in this little cryptic figure that I drew right before class. Just describe it.
The beginning is skinnier and the end
has
longer strands.
What is this line right here?
Is that the, like, DNA?
What would you think that is? You're asking a question.
A strand of DNA?
Yeah. You're positive. Okay?
Pretty positive.
Okay. Confident.
Very confident.
Good. And it's a strand of DNA. And what are these things?
The complementary, like, the bases?
No. What are these things? You said that's the strand of DNA. The bases aren't going to be coming off of the DNA. They're part of the DNA. They're holding the DNA together. What are these little things coming off? What's your hypothesis? What could they be?
Maybe RNA that's maybe. Coming off of...
Just give me a hypothesis. I don't want maybes. I don't want I don't knows. I don't want a thinks. I want a hypothesis. Doesn't mean it's right or wrong. I just want a hypothesis.
My hypothesis would be that the RNA coming off of, like, the complementary RNA.
Okay. If the RNA comes off of that strand of DNA, where would the RNA be longest? At the beginning or the end of the gene?
The end.
Okay. Now, from this little cryptic diagram, where is the longest little thing that you're hypothesizing to be RNA coming off?
The end.
And is it short here?
Yes.
So the RNA is getting longer and longer and longer and longer? Come on, you're doing well.
Yes.
Yeah. So where would the end of the gene be?
Where the RNA is longest, at the top?
Maybe up here. Where would the beginning of the gene be?
Where the RNA is shortest.
Because the beginning of the gene is where the RNA starts. So it's got to be short at the beginning of the gene and longer at the end because it's copying, as you'll see, one strand of the gene. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
How would you show that those little Christmas trees are RNA, Heather? What could you do to show that it's specifically RNA? Think back to the Avery experiment. We talked about it last week in class. Go ahead.
Look specifically at the bases?
No, give me an experiment that you could do. Think about what Avery did we talked about it in class last week. It was in your book. It was in the chapter 2 of your book. What did Avery do? Mm-hmm. How did Avery eliminate RNA as being the genetic material? What experiment did he do?
Oh, I don't remember.
What did he do? Charles? What did he do?
Avery?
Yeah.
Is Avery the same guy as Griffith? What's the guy with the rats?
No, Avery. We talked about it in class.
I know he's not the same guy.
Josh?
If you could somehow take that and mix it with an enzyme.
Good.
That
what enzyme would you use?
The enzyme that specifically digests RNA.
Yeah, and
not
what would
DNA.
You see? What would go away?
All
what would you predict?
The fuzzy part?
Yeah, all the fuzzy parts would go away. So if you wanted to know that this was RNA, you'd treat it with this ribonuclease enzyme, and the fuzzy parts would go away. That would be your prediction. And if they don't go away, then it probably wasn't RNA. But if you did that experiment, they will go away. Because that is RNA. Now, if you wanted to know that this little stick here is DNA, as Heather hypothesized, what would you do?
The same process, but now using an enzyme that would digest
DNA. Excellent. Degrade DNA. Absolutely. And then you'd see that all this stuff would just basically disappear.
Is digest the right term?
Yeah, digest is perfect term.
Okay.
Perfect term. So, in essence, that's what we're looking at. So we're looking at a gene, we're looking at a series of genes, and what this electron micrograph shows is that, one, genes are next to each other. What this electron micrograph shows that genes have a beginning and an end, very specific and very defined. Electron micrograph shows that there's a separation between genes, because you can see a place in this picture right here where there aren't any of these fuzzy things, these RNA molecules, that is the space between genes. And so using the electron microscope, you can visualize DNA, you can visualize RNA, and you can visualize genes in action, meaning genes are being transcribed into RNA, and you can verify that those substances are RNA and DNA, and you can do it very nicely. What it's also showing is that the gene makes many, 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 many copies of a specific RNA, because you see all these fuzzy things. And each one of those fuzzy things is one RNA. And so what I'm saying is that a gene just isn't transcribed into RNA once, but it's transcribed into RNA literally millions of times. And all of this is happening at the same time. We'll get into that a little bit more next week. But the point is that this is gene, and this is gene action. Does everyone see that? Is that clear? Nick.
Thanks. So on your Christmas tree drawing on the right there, the long strand of DNA, that's not one gene.
This is one gene.
Oh, that's all one gene?
All one gene. All of these RNAs that are being made are all the exact same RNA. So one is starting here.
Oh, okay.
Another one is elongating. So all we're doing is starting RNAs at this point, and whatever's making the RNA, called RNA polymerase, an enzyme, is moving along the gene, and as it moves along the gene, RNAs get longer and longer and longer. So it's kind of like a Xerox machine going at the same time.
So each one of the little Christmas tree branches is an individual copy of the whole DNA strand. Okay.
In motion, though. So the small one is just a copy of the beginning of the gene. The long one is a copy, a transcript of the entire gene. Heather?
How quickly does this process occur? I mean,
In picoseconds. A picosecond is a 10^-12 seconds. So you can transcribe a gene a million times in less than a minute. Obviously, because, you know, like a bacterial cell divides every few minutes. So you got to transcribe every gene millions of times in a very short period of time. There are some constraints. It's a little bit too technical to go into it, but the constraint really is the geometry of the polymerase which transcribes the gene. In other words, it has a shape. It's like a little machine and it has to grab onto the DNA. So therefore, because it has a certain space, it can only allow another one to grab onto the gene when it moves a certain distance. But they can be touching each other, as you can see. They can be very compact. It's kind of like, you know, bumper to bumper on a freeway, so to speak. Okay, so now, what's the gene that you're looking at? What is this thing called the gene? And now we're going to get, it's going to be a little bit of a review, but we're going to get a little bit Bob Goldberg-ish, so follow along with me. A gene is a unique sequence of nucleotides. Not any kind of nucleotide, but a deoxyribonucleotide. Nucleotides that are in DNA, not RNA. We'll talk about that and review that in a second. So a gene is a sequence, a unique sequence of nucleotides. And a sequence, as you know from your quiz number 2, or you should, since most of you did pretty well on it, you know that the sequence begins at what we call the 5 prime and ends at what we call the 3 prime. And that doesn't mean anything to you right now, but it will in about 10 minutes. So the beginning of a gene is always called 5 prime, the end of the gene is always called 3 prime, and the sequence of a gene is always the sequence that codes for a protein. Remember, genes have 2 strands of DNA. The DNA is a double helix. So one strand codes for the protein and the other strand doesn't. And so the sequence of a gene is very unique. It goes 5 prime to 3 prime, and that sequence is defined in terms of the protein coding information. The other strand doesn't code for protein. Now I'm going to get to that in a second. The other strand's complementary to the gene, but not the same sequence. And it's not the sequence in the opposite direction. It's a complementary sequence, a totally different sequence. So a gene is a unique sequence of nucleotides, deoxyribonucleotides, and every gene has its own sequence, 5 prime to 3 prime. And a gene consists of nucleotides, and those nucleotides are bound together by these things called phosphodiester bonds that you read about in the double helix and read about in your book, and we're going to review it in a couple of seconds. But the point here is that this is biology. The unique gene has a unique sequence of DNA. And the reason why I can reconstruct a gene from hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen, and oxygen is because I know what the sequence is. And so I can make this gene. This happens to be the gene that specifies the red color in your blood cells. This is a globin gene that holds oxygen. If you don't have this gene, you're dead because you can't breathe. And so the point here is that the gene goes 5 prime to 3 prime. It's a unique sequence. Every gene has its own unique sequence. There's no sequences that are the same between genes. That's why they specify different proteins. And a genome is a unique collection of genes, and the sequence of each genome is different. Sequence of the rat genome is different than the human genome. Sequence of the human genome is different than the plant genome, whatever. So this is what a gene is. And the gene is based in chemistry, can't escape it, and that chemistry leads to unique functions. So this chemistry, 5 prime to 3 prime, and that is chemistry, it's biochemistry, leads to a unique function. The glowfish gene has a unique sequence of nucleotides from 5 prime to 3 prime, and that unique sequence of nucleotides is the only sequence of nucleotides that exists on the face of this earth that can give rise to that particular protein, and it's simply a bunch of chemicals strung together, nucleotides, by phosphodiester bonds, and that piece of chemical is able to take that pig and turn it into a green pig. It's just a chemical. Think about that. A chemical. Think about that. It has a lot of philosophical implications there that we've been talking about. So that means if you know the sequence, you can do anything. I'm going to say that again. If you know the sequence of the gene, you can do anything. No limitations. I'm going to pop your eyes out in a few minutes, so bear with me. So let me just review some chemistry. Lisa. Lisa, I missed you on Thursday. Were you here?
Yeah, I was actually here last Thursday. But
go ahead.
So if you know the sequence, you can do anything.
Speak
but,
into the...
But didn't you also say that you had to know how the genes interacted with other genes in order to actually
if you know
do
the
things?
Sequence, it automatically interacts with other genes.
Okay.
If you know the sequence, all the other genes are there, and it's an automatic interaction.
Okay.
And I'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Okay.
So all you have to know is the sequence, to engineer the gene, to make it different, to change it, to transform something, to do something, to take that pig and make it glow green in the dark. We engineer that pig by sticking in the glowfish gene. All we have to know is that sequence, or have that sequence. We have to know something that we have that gene. And generally, as we've talked about in this class, the only way you know that you have the gene or the cDNA or whatever is to know the sequence. We talked about that in discussion in week 2. Brian, you have a question? Okay, good. Okay, let me review a little bit of this chemistry. And this is a review, and so I'm not going to go over it in any depth, but I think it'll be the first time you've ever heard of this stuff in reality. A nucleotide is the basis of all the genes that you know. And the nucleotide consists of a series of atoms and molecules. It consists of a base, a sugar, and a phosphate. And the base and the sugar and the phosphate come together into a nucleotide. Kind of bear with me because I'm going to get a little bit more specific than this in a couple seconds. Those nucleotides are strung together in a specific order. 5 prime is the beginning, 3 prime is the end. Always. Always. And the nucleotides are strung together during replication by the production of a specific bond called a phosphodiester bond. And a specific enzyme makes that bond called DNA polymerase, which is a protein, very complicated protein. And so during replication, as you'll see, one strand serves as a template for the other strand to get a double helix. Okay? Now, let me talk about this nucleotide. And this is the nub of it. And I want you to listen to every single solitary word that I have to say, because this is the basis of all genetics, right here. 5 prime to 3 prime refers to the sugar. The order of a gene derives from the chemistry of a sugar. You must know this. It's critical. You cannot understand genetics or DNA or genetic engineering without understanding a few simple rules. It's not that complicated. And I'm not giving you a class in chemistry because I don't want to do that. But I want you to understand what this 5 prime to 3 prime means and where it came from. The sugar is what I call the hub. The sugar is the hub. The sugar binds the base. The sugar binds the phosphate. And the sugar phosphate links two nucleotides together. The nucleotides are not linked by the bases. The nucleotides are linked by the sugars and the phosphates. The sugar has polarity. In organic chemistry, this would be called a 5-carbon sugar. 1 carbon, 2 carbon, 3 carbons, 4 carbons, 5 carbons. Sugars consist of carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, simple carbohydrates. You use these all the time as an energy source. This is what's in those M&Ms on my little table there. You eat them as food, you break them down, and they're also the main component of DNA and RNA. We have a sugar that has a 1-prime carbon, a 2-prime carbon, 3-prime carbon, a 4-prime carbon, and a 5-prime carbon. That gives polarity to the nucleotide. Notice that the phosphate is attached to this particular carbon, only that carbon of the sugar. Phosphate's never attached to any other sugar carbon. It's always to this 5-prime carbon. It's just the chemistry involved. I'll tell you why in a second. Notice that the base is always linked to the 1-prime carbon. Always. Never, ever, ever varies. And notice that the 3-prime carbon here has an OH. 3-prime carbon has an OH called a hydroxyl group. It's not important to know what the name is. Just notice the different groups that are attached. And notice in the case of the 2-prime carbon, there's no oxygen. So this is a deoxyribose sugar. There's no oxygen. There's just a hydrogen here. But in a ribose sugar, you'd have another oxygen. I'm not going to get into that because it's not important for this discussion. What is important for this discussion is that there's a 5-prime end of the sugar and a 3-prime end of the sugar, and they have different chemistries. 5-prime has the phosphate, 3-prime has the hydroxyl. That's very important for genes. That's very important in making the pig glow green. That's very important in terms of understanding how a gene works, because the order of a gene is from the 5-prime carbon to the 3-prime carbon of a sugar. That's where the order comes from. The order in which nucleotides are put in a gene is from a 5-prime to a 3-prime. I know it sounds confusing now, but in about 3 minutes you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. So we have a hub. We have a sugar. The sugar has carbons. The carbons have numbers. And the numbers have specific atoms that are associated with those carbons. Why is it specific? Because the sugar is made inside of a cell. The sugar is made. And the sugar is synthesized by enzymes. There's genes that are responsible for making these sugars. What happens if you have a defect in the manufacture of this particular base in your cells? What do you think, Lisa? Just hypothesize something. Let me make it a bacteria. What if the bacteria can't make this nucleotide? What do you think would happen? I can't hear you.
It would be dysfunctional.
And what if it's a bacteria, what will happen?
It would die.
It would be dead. So if the bacteria has a defect in enzymes that synthesize these nucleotides, it's lethal. And these nucleotides are synthesized literally in your cells and in bacterial cells from carbons and hydrogens by enzymes that work on them. And those enzymes are specified by particular genes. Now, Josh, what do you think if you have a defect in one of these nucleotides in your cells, in human cells? What do you think, what would you hypothesize to be one of the consequences?
I would hypothesize that a human organism should not be created without...
Let me backtrack. You don't synthesize your nucleotides. You eat them. We don't synthesize nucleotides. We eat them. That's why you got to eat food from things that synthesize. But you break down nucleotides and you recycle them. In other words, these DNA molecules and RNA molecules are always being degraded and the nucleotides are being reused. Those are very specific processes. So what would you suggest if the metabolism of this particular nucleotide doesn't occur normally? If it's not, let's say, broken down in its normal way, that there's some defect, what would you...
The nucleotide?
Yeah, this nucleotide. If it's not, if it's used and not broken down and basically peed out. In other words, everything inside your cell is turning over. You use it, degrade it, reuse it. Use it, degrade it, reuse it. We have sustainable systems here, seriously. What would you think if there was a defect in breaking down this nucleotide? What did Garrod find about inborn errors of metabolism? Remember, we talked about Garrod. We had a whole lecture on Garrod and eugenics and inborn errors of metabolism.
I do not know.
It's in chapter one of your text. In lectures 1, 2, and 3 in my class. What do you think, Samantha? What did Garrod show at the turn of the century? Now I'll go to T. We haven't called on her for a while. What about Garrod? Remember inborn errors of metabolism? Phenylketonuria? We had it in discussion? What's going on?
I honestly don't remember.
What is it?
Wouldn't it be that if it couldn't be broken down properly, it would the concentration would end up being lethal?
To the cell.
To the cell and the general human? Or would it kill the human?
Maybe, maybe not. Yeah. Maybe, maybe not. Phenylketonuria doesn't kill you. Adenine deaminase doesn't kill you. It causes bubble babies, but doesn't kill you. Remember we talked about adenine deaminase being a defect in the people with severe combined immunodeficiency. Got to look over your notes here. When was the last time you looked over your notes, Sommer? Have you even looked them over once during the quarter? Did you? No, be honest. I don't mind. Everyone is pressed for time. I don't mind. Just you're turning red. Be honest. When was the last time you looked over your notes, T? What are you going to do 2 weeks from now when I call you down here and you have an oral exam and I ask you all these questions? I hope so. But you should be ready now, and then you'll be ready then. In any case, if you have a defect in the metabolism of this nucleotide, you can get many kinds of disorders because of toxic levels of this nucleotide going up in cells. And one of the disorders is called Lesch-Nyhan disease for the individuals that discovered this disorder. A simple defect in the metabolism of a nucleotide causes Lesch-Nyhan disease. And Becca, you know what Lesch-Nyhan disease does? Self-mutilation syndrome. People who have a defect in the metabolism of a simple nucleotide literally try and bite their fingers off, their arms off, their skin. They bite. It's horrible disease, uncontrollably, because they have a toxic level of a nucleotide, that's not broken down properly. So the point here is, hold your question, Betty. I'll come back to it. The point here is we have these nucleotides. They're made by metabolic processes inside the cell. That means they're made by reactions. They don't just appear. Or they're metabolized. That is, they're broken down. They're either made or they're broken down. And those enzymes are made by are encoded by specific genes. And that's why the base is put on the 1' carbon, the phosphate on the 5' carbon, because specific enzymes control those reactions. Very specifically. It's not a random thing. None of this is random. It's highly specific going on inside your cells right now. Now, why is this important? Why am I even going into this stuff? I'm going into it because this is the basis of a gene. Notice that here's the strand of DNA. And the way in which the nucleotides are put together is they are joined. The enzyme catalyzes a phosphodiester bond, but notice where I'm putting the 5' and 3'. Here's the first nucleotide. It has a free phosphate at this 5' carbon. So all, let's say, strands of DNA end with this phosphate coming out, and that specifies the 5' end. Notice that this nucleotide right here is attached from this 5' to this 3', and there's the phosphodiester bond. And notice that there's a polarity here. 5', 3', 5', 3', and notice the end of this dinucleotide with two nucleotides has at the 3' end this OH group. I want to go through this and then you can ask questions. So notice there's a polarity, a chemical polarity. You can see it. You don't have to understand the chemistry, but you can see that there's a 5' phosphate at the end of a DNA molecule attached to this very specific carbon. Notice that at the at the beginning. At the end of the DNA molecule, at this 3' sugar, there's a specific hydroxyl. This chemistry is dictating the order of that dinucleotide. It's this nucleotide, nucleotide 1, nucleotide 2, in that order. Only order. There is no other order. 5' to 3'. And that's the basis of all biological specificity. That's the basis of every single thing you see in this room. Can you guys all stand up? Just look at each other. Every single trait that you have that's different, every single trait you have is because of this to this being different. Daisy's hair color and hair is a different protein than her skin, and the proteins in her skin, because the genes are different only because of the order of those nucleotides and nothing else. It's the same nucleotides in a different order. And I happen to say that the color of your skin and the color of your hair and your eyes and everything else are very profoundly different simply because of this chemistry, which is going on, you guys can sit, in a very specific way. And I want to make that point that you can see it now. The beginning of the gene is 5', the end of the gene is 3'. The beginning of a DNA is 5', the end of the DNA is 3'. It's an order. The order of a genome of a human is different than the order of a genome of a plant. The order of human chromosome 22 is different than the order of human chromosome 16, because simply the nucleotides going from this 5' phosphate to the 3' hydroxyl is different. Think about that. Just a simple difference in chemistry can lead to absolute profound differences in what we do. And because we know this order, and because we know this bond, and we know all these chemicals, we can synthesize this stuff in any order we want. Okay, let's move forward a little bit more. So we have this order. And now we go from two nucleotides. We go from two nucleotides to 3 and 4 nucleotides. So notice we have a phosphate at this 5' end, the beginning of a DNA. Notice that we have this O at this 3' end, and now the phosphate is attached. The phosphate is attached to the C at the 5' end of the next sugar. We have an O at the 3' end. It's attached to the 5' end, which is attached to this C of this sugar, and so on and so forth. Phosphodiester bond, phosphodiester bond, phosphodiester bond. 5' with the phosphate, 3' with the hydroxyl, nucleotide 1, G, nucleotide 2, nucleotide 3, A, C. G, T, A, C, very specific order. That order specifies very specific RNA, specifies very specific protein. One and only one RNA, one and only one gene, one and only one RNA, one protein, all from the order of these nucleotides in a very specific, in a very unique way, all in the chemistry. Again, the sugar is the hub. The sugar has 1', 2', 3', 4', 5' carbons. Phosphate's always at the 5' carbon. Hydroxyl at the 2', at the 3' carbon. 5' phosphate's always at the end of a DNA molecule, the beginning. 3' hydroxyl always at the end of the DNA molecule, the end. The order in between of nucleotides is always unique, and that's what's copied faithfully generation after generation after generation, unless there's a mutation. Betty, you had a question. I love talking about this stuff. Absolutely love it.
Oh, it's actually not a question, but in high school we did a report on the mesh line like disease, mm-hmm. and how, because they can't break down uric acid, it gathers in their joints and it's painful gout for little kids.
It's related to gout, but it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm.
And how like they self-mutilate and have to restrain completely for as long as they live, or else their teeth have to be removed because they bite themselves. And how they stick pencils and like crayons into their eyes and try
pretty
to
bad, isn't it?
Yeah, they try to jab their fingers on the spokes of the wheelchair, and ever since they were a baby, like, they like to be tied up completely because they were scared they would hurt
pretty
themselves.
Sad, isn't it?
Yeah, so
very sad.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to talk about things in discussion tomorrow that can prevent that from happening, okay, with DNA testing. Daisy?
I was just going to ask, are we going to learn about the different, like, chemical differences between all of the bases and, like, why?
In 2 minutes.
Oh, cool.
Go ahead. Radina? I'm eating some M&Ms. I haven't eaten in 2 days, so I'm running low on sugar.
So is the Lesch-Nyhan disease, is that considered a psychological disease based on a genetic disorder? Or is it?
I wouldn't think it would be considered a psychological disease. It's just an inborn error in metabolism that causes a very serious defects, some of which are mental defects.
That's what I mean.
So I wouldn't call that psychological in the sense of being psychological, but it affects, like any mental retardation, has a number of different syndromes associated with it. Okay. Is there any questions on this polarity? Kyle, you understand? Ryan, you with me? Okay, go ahead.
I was just wondering what happened to the hydroxyl group on the end of the three primes when it joins with the phosphate group. Because I see the negative charge on top of the phosphate group on the five prime. Mm-hmm. And then I thought OH was always negative too, so I was just wondering how that worked.
Well, in essence, you're correct. Okay, but it depends upon the pH and everything else, and it's way beyond the scope of this class, and I'm sure Hannah doesn't really want to know about that, and I don't want to get into it, okay? Are there any other questions? Okay. Conceptually, I hope you're with me. Go ahead. Question.
When you say polarity, what does that mean? When you say there's a polarity there, I don't understand what that means.
Well, what do you think polarity means? What does polarity mean to you?
I think it means like when things are polar, like polar opposites, they're completely opposite from one another.
Yeah, so it could be east and west. It could be five and prime and three prime. It could be, you know, friend and foe.
It's just that they're on the opposite sides of one another? That's the five prime and the three prime?
In a sense, yes. They're at the beginning and the end.
Okay.
That's absolutely true. Okay. Now, Daisy asked about the nucleotides. All of this, obviously, is a review, because there's no way you could write your DNA double helix essay without knowing any of this. And all of this is in your Watson double helix book, and all of this stuff was in the film Race for the DNA, and all of this is in chapter 1 and 2 of your text. None of this is new. What's new is sort of the conceptual basis in which I'm telling you it. So we have these different nucleotides, and the basis of the difference in these nucleotides, I don't want to see it. The difference in these nucleotides, leave them outside. Leave them outside. The difference in these nucleotides in terms of the chemistry, in fact, we're not going to do it today. We're going to maybe do it tomorrow unless I run into a little bit more time. I'll let you know. Okay, thanks. So the difference in the chemistry is simply the basis of the difference in the nucleotides. And again, I'm not going to go into any of this from a specific point of view because I don't want to. It's just conceptually. The chemistry leads to biological specificity. If you look at the chemistry of the adenine, you see it has two rings, a big one and a little one, and you see at the top it has an NH2 group. It's a specific series of atoms, N and hydrogen. And if you compare that to, let's say, guanine, you can see it has a big ring and a little ring, but it has an oxygen here where that has that. That simple difference in chemistry is simply the difference between an adenine and a guanine. And I'm not going to get into that because those of you that are not science majors only have to know about this conceptually, and those of you that are science majors are going to have this so many times that you'll be sick of it during your career. But the point here is, conceptually, that chemistry leads to unique biology. There's nothing mysterious about what's going on inside of your cells. I know you might not want to hear this, but you're really just a bag of chemicals. But a bag of chemicals that's put together in a very specific way. And a gene is a series of nucleotides, which are chemicals, and the nucleotides differ simply by the atoms that are there contained in each of those nucleotides. So each of the nucleotides, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, has a different chemistry. And that's why they're different. But they all share same features. They have a base, which gives it its specificity. Adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine are bases. They're connected to a sugar, They're all deoxyribose sugars with five carbons, and they're all connected in the same way. The base to the one prime carbon, phosphate to the five prime carbon, hydroxyl to the three prime carbon. And they're all strung together by phosphodiester bonds, five prime to three prime, five prime to three prime, five prime to three prime. And those five primes to three primes are simply a manifestation of the chemistry of the sugars. And so in the DNA molecule, as you know, there are these four different kinds of nucleotides, and only four. More specifically called deoxyadenylic acid, deoxythymidylic acid, deoxycytidylic acid, and deoxyguanylic acid. Thymine, guanine, cytosine, and adenine. They have different chemistry, but they look about the same. It's just these atoms. And in any DNA molecule, as you know from your double helix essay, any double-stranded DNA molecule, A equals T and G equals C, and that's Chargaff's rules. And the reason for that is adenine pairs with thymine and guanine pairs with cytosine, as you know. And therefore, the amount of adenine must equal the amount of thymine, the amount of guanine must equal the amount of cytosine, and that's true, and Chargaff found that out a long time ago. So, conceptually, we have these nucleotides. Nucleotides are bound together by phosphodiester bonds. Phosphodiester bonds bind the nucleotides into chains, and those chains can vary in length. Those chains can vary in length from a small DNA virus, which might be 1,000 nucleotides in length, to maybe the size of an X chromosome in humans, in which the length of a DNA molecule can be hundreds of millions of nucleotides in length. So these chains can be small, relatively, or huge. And it's the order in which these nucleotides are put together that dictates, hold your question, Nick, I'll come back to you. The order in which these nucleotides, I'll come back to you in a sec, okay? Orders in which these nucleotides are put together, that determines the biological specificity. Now, the DNA molecule of most organisms is double-stranded. However, there are single-stranded DNA molecules in certain viruses. So I don't want you to leave this room saying all DNA is a double helix. That's not true. 99.99% of all DNA molecules are double helices, but some viruses have single strands of DNA as their genetic material. No cellular-based organism has a single strand of DNA as its genetic material. They're all double-stranded. And the DNA molecule has very specific features, which I think most of you are aware of, but I just want to review. We have a double-stranded DNA, and there are two strands that are going in opposite directions. And you should know from your double helix essay in reading the double helix that they have to go in opposite directions because that's the only way they fit spatially together. It's not by chance, it's the way they fit. In other words, the geometry of the molecule is such that they only fit by going in opposite directions. So one strand goes 5 prime to 3 prime, the other strand goes 3 prime to 5 prime. And furthermore, the backbone of the molecule are the phosphodiester bonds. So on the outside of the DNA is the phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. Phosphate is 5 prime, 3 prime hydroxyl, the sugar is 3 prime. You see that, Sama? Very clear now, isn't it? It's no longer confusing anymore, is it? Notice that opposite polarity, we have a 3 prime hydroxyl. Now we have a 5 prime phosphate because we're going in that direction. So we have 5 prime, 3 prime, 3 prime phosphate, opposite polarity. The only reason why they're in opposite polarity is the only way the bases fit together to the inside. The bases are to the inside. The bases are bound to the sugar by the 1 prime carbon. Phosphate bound to the sugar by the 5 prime carbon. Phosphodiester bonds link them together 5 prime to 3 prime. And notice the bases are on the inside and they're complementary to each other. Chargaff's rules, A pairs with T, G pairs with C, and hydrogen bonds between them. And it's not important to know what hydrogen bonds are, but it's a specific bond. It's a weaker bond than a phosphodiester bond. A phosphodiester bond is what we call a covalent bond. Hydrogen bond is what we call a hydrogen bond. The hydrogen bond is weak so that when you heat the DNA up, you can break the chains of the DNA. You know that a little bit. When you heat the DNA up, you don't break the phosphodiester bonds. In order to break the phosphodiester bonds, you need an enzyme, or in the case of your DNA sequencing, you need specific chemicals. They're stable. So we have a very stable molecule inside the cell, and it's a double helix, phosphodiester bonds on the outside, hydrogen bonds on the inside, complementary bases. The sequence of this strand differs from the sequence of the other. That's a very important conceptual point. They're complementary to each other, but the sequence is different. The sequence of this strand, 5 prime to 3 prime, is different than the sequence of that strand, 5 prime to 3 prime. They're complementary. If you know the sequence of one strand, you automatically know the sequence of the other. And this molecule has the ability to dictate all of the proteins in your cell. It has to dictate the properties to be able to replicate, express itself, and do everything else. And furthermore, there's no constraints on sequence. You can have an infinite number of sequences. You have 4 nucleotides. If you have 1,000,000 nucleotides in the DNA chain, there's 4 to the 1,000,000th power of different combinations. So there's an infinite number of different sequences that can be generated. And the more bases you have in the chain, the more numbers of combinations you can have. And so the chances of having any two genomes that are the same of each other is impossible, basically. Hannah. Different situation. I mean, twins are twins because they're twins because they're, you know, twins. But I'm talking about the difference between a mouse and a human being. In other words, the chances of having two organisms that have exactly the same genome is just virtually impossible by virtue of the number of different combinations that these things can be put together. Hannah. Because I'm going to move on. Not Hannah, I'm sorry. Heather.
How do you know which strand of the DNA?
Haven't told you yet.
Okay.
Good question. How do you know which strand of the DNA is the gene? But I'm going to tell you in a second. How do you know which strand is the one that specifies the protein? How do you know the other one, what it does? Okay. You guys want a 5-minute break?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Mike, we're going to hold off on that for a bit. Let's come back at 5 minutes after 5. I think that was great. I think that was great, Gloria. It's fantastic. Oh my God. So much fun. Good. I love talking about this stuff. Absolutely love it. Why am I telling you about this? You know, I know many of you aren't really so keen on understanding the chemistry of adenylic acid and its esoteric properties in alkaline solution. I'm telling you this because this is the basis of all biology. And why I'm sharing you this stuff with you is because when I think about these things, I think about an enormous amount of precision. I think about the most incredible precision that you could ever imagine. And I think about all of these chemical reactions that are going on inside of all of your cells at all of the same time, all dictated by enzymes that are specified by genes. We'll learn a little bit more next week, but there's about 5,000 genes just in the human genome that just goes into making a DNA molecule. So you need genes to make genes. But I'm talking about it because I know that it's hard to really appreciate, and it raises a lot of philosophical issues. But in a sense, this is where our consciousness lies, and I mean that. It's in the order of the sequence of the bases. And the reason that I say that is because the order of the sequence of the bases gives rise to all the proteins that give rise to us, including your central nervous system in your brain, which is where consciousness exists. And so therefore, ultimately, everything that we are and everything that we do derives back to the chemistry of these sugars and bases and phosphates and five primes and three primes and three primes and five primes and all of that. And in order to understand the biological basis of who we are, in order to appreciate the sequence of the human genome, in order to appreciate being able to synthesize a gene, which is something that we just take for granted, but it's just so amazing that you need to understand a little bit about the chemistry. And no, it's not important for you to understand that adenylic acid has a... adenylic acid is really, you know, 6-aminopurine. You don't need to know that. But what you do need to know is that adenylic acid is different from thymidylic acid simply because of its chemistry is different. Has some similarities, but has some differences. And those differences can lead to profound differences. If you mutate an adenylic acid to a thymidylic acid, it could mean the difference between being a normal, healthy child and being a child with Lesch-Nyhan disease. That's only a difference between an amino group at the same position of a purine and something else. We're talking about a slight difference in chemistry leading to a horrific, horrific, horrific disease. Or slight differences in chemistry leading to the genetic variability that is in this room. It all comes down to these bases, the order, and the way in which they're put together. And that's why I'm telling you about this, so that when we talk about the order of genes, you at least have some idea conceptually of what it means. Not in any real specific way, not because I need you to know that at a certain pH, those hydroxyls lose their hydrogen, and that's the basis of pH. No, I don't care if you know about that. But I do care that you know that there's an order to the strands of the DNA, and that each strand has a different order, and that they're complementary to each other, and that the order of those chemicals in the gene is different for each gene. And the order of those chemicals in a genome is different from another genome. And that's the concept. And in essence, if you think about it, in the way in which I think about it, that DNA molecule is immortal. I mean, you have DNA molecules in you, at least the sequences that existed from the time of Adam and Eve in immemorial. It never ends and it never begins. It's always there. That I find to be at least so profound that sometimes it's almost difficult to comprehend, because it leads to the questions of where those DNA molecules came from. Where do those nucleotides come from? How do they first get strung together? How do they get strung together in a specific order? How did that specific order lead to the first protein? How did that specific order lead to the first ability of that primitive gene to replicate? Where did all this stuff come from? And if it came from somewhere, we should be able to replicate it, and we will be able to replicate it. And if any of you think that we're not going to be able to duplicate this stuff and create an organism, you're mistaken, because we will. And I'll show you in a few minutes that we can already create unique life forms by manipulating simply these sequences and these genes. And so that's why I want you to understand it. I want you to understand it because, to me, it's very profound. And it gives substance and meaning to what we and all the other creatures on the face of this earth are all about. That it's just, there's something that led us to have the biology that we have, and it's in the order of these nucleotides in these DNA molecules, and that they're pumping away as we sit in this room, literally billions and trillions of RNA molecules and trillions of enzymes and reactions going on, and it's all highly specific, and it's so specific and it's so complex that we haven't even been able to scratch the surface of its complexity. I mean, we are in the dark ages in terms of understanding the complexity of these biological things that we call cells and organisms, but someday we'll get there. So let me just pick up. We have this double-stranded DNA, and this double-stranded DNA contains the genes, and the sum total of the genes are found in what we call chromosomes. And chromosomes are simply DNA molecules. That's all they are. So we have a number of different chromosomes in our nuclei. You know, we have 22 autosomes and two X and two sex chromosomes, an X and a Y. And each of those chromosomes is simply a DNA molecule from one end to another, a double-stranded DNA molecule from one end to another, and a DNA molecule that has a very specific sequence. And so genes are organized into chromosomes, and the reason why genes are organized into chromosomes is simply to make it easy for a cell to distribute those genes perfectly at each cell division. Imagine if a cell had 5,000 different genes and they weren't connected to each other. Imagine how hard it would be to replicate that information faithfully each time the cell divided. The chance of an error would be enormous. And so cells have chromosomes to guarantee the organism that the genes will be distributed equally and without mistakes every time a cell divides. And obviously that's the key to biology, because we all started out as one cell, fertilized egg, a zygote, and now look at us with trillions of cells. We all have the same genome, as we talked about. And so if there weren't genes organized in the chromosomes, the chances of mistakes would be enormous, and if you have mistakes, it can lead to lethality. It could cause us not even to develop or die. So we have genes organized in chromosomes. Each chromosome is a specific DNA molecule. You're looking at a small human chromosome in the electron microscope. That might be a chromosome 21. It might be a chromosome 22. You're looking at a chromosome with two DNA molecules, because because you're looking at a chromosome after the DNA is replicated. So this DNA molecule is identical to that DNA molecule. Each side of this chromosome is one of these double helices. So in this chromosome, after duplication, you have two double helices of sequences that are exactly the same. But they're organized into chromosomes because there's literally thousands of genes on that chromosome. And this small one might be 100 million nucleotides in length. It might be 100 million nucleotides from here to here. And larger ones are, of course, bigger. So the chromosomes in higher organisms, such as plants and animals and fungi, are linear. And we know that from now the sequence of the genome. We know it's linear. They have defined ends. Each chromosome has a 5' end and a 3' end, and the sequence is different from another chromosome. But the chromosomes of most bacteria, but not all, these rules can be broken, is circular. It's like a plasmid, meaning the chromosome of E. coli, which has also been sequenced, that chromosome is a circle. It has no beginning and it has no end, per se. It's a circle. And you can demonstrate that by the DNA sequence. You can also demonstrate that by restriction sites and a variety of other ways in which you'll have an opportunity to do on your take-home test. But the point here is that you have a circle for bacteria, you have a circle for many viruses, you have a circle for everything except eukaryotes, fungi, plants, animals. They have DNA molecules in chromosomes that are linear. And furthermore, getting back to Heather's question, the genes reside at specific locations along the chromosome. The gene has a specific location, an absolute specific location. It's like the Christmas tree. The gene has a defined beginning, the 5' end, and the 3' end. The gene has a defined beginning, the 5' end, and the 3' end. But notice we have gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, gene 4, gene 5, gene 6, gene 7. There are 7 genes on this little part of a chromosome here. But notice that the RNA, or the orientation of the polarity of the gene, is random. We have 2 strands of the DNA. Okay, one's going 5', one's going 3'. Remember I said that the gene sequence is defined as the sequence that specifies the protein. So this arrow is the gene sequence that specifies the protein. So that means that the gene sequence that specifies the protein of this gene is on this strand. And the gene sequence that specifies the protein of this gene is on that strand. And so what I'm saying is that each gene has a defined beginning and a defined end. But on a given chromosome, let's say the Watson strand of the DNA could be what makes the protein of one gene, but the Crick strand of the other gene is what makes the protein for that gene. And so which strand is what makes the protein, or that has the protein information, is random. The answer is there's no rhyme or reason to it. It just happened. And some genes can go in this direction, some genes can go in that direction on a given chromosome. And you don't know that until you sequence it. And Mike and Gloria spent a lot of time trying to figure that one out when they took my HC70AL lab, remember? And what was the orientation of the gene on the chromosome? So what I'm saying here is that genes are located along chromosomes. And chromosomes have many genes. The E. coli chromosome has 5,000 genes all connected to each other. Each of those genes has a defined beginning and defined end. But each of those genes is a double-stranded DNA molecule. One strand specifies the protein, and the other strand is just there for structure. And which strand specifies the protein is a random process. It's an absolutely random process. And so that means, Nick, that this gene could be determining the protein off of this strand, and that gene could be determining what protein is made off of that strand, but that they're next to each other. So that means the polarity or direction of the gene goes in this direction on that strand and that direction on that strand. What I'm saying is that each gene only has one strand that contributes to specifying the protein in the cell, And the complementary strand is just there because the DNA is double-stranded. It's a double helix. It has a structure to it, but it's a very specific thing. And you don't know the orientation of these genes until you actually sequence them. And the orientation, Heather, is determined by which strand has the genetic code. And the genetic code is very specific, 3 nucleotides each. And if you can read the genetic code out without any nonsense, then you know that's the orientation of the gene on that strand. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So each gene resides at a specific location on a chromosome. And there's a set of human chromosomes. And I'm not going to tell you how this is done, but look, there's genes here. And these are chromosomes that have been duplicated. It's after the division of the DNA, the replication. And so there's a DNA molecule and a DNA molecule, and they're identical to each other. And here's the position of this gene, here's the position of that gene, here's the position of that gene, position of that gene. You can see these genes and where they're localized on the chromosomes. And for your article for discussion tomorrow, you'll learn a little bit, not very much, about how you can position those genes. I'm going to talk a lot about that in class, but here's a human chromosome. I think it's the X chromosome. Notice that these genes for human diseases lie along the length of this chromosome. And for discussion tomorrow, you're going to begin to learn how you associate a given trait with a given gene and with a given chromosome and how you're able to follow it through a family using pedigree. And so in this particular, you can see all kinds of genes that cause very, very, very profound and very specific human diseases. And we know the sequence of this chromosome there, in fact, is the Lesch-Nyhan syndrome gene. It's right there on the X chromosome. And I could go on for many, many more of these, but it's not important. So when we look at this chromosome number 22 in humans, what you see is the following. A big chromosome of about 50 million nucleotides in DNA. Daisy, is that before or after DNA replication? After. That's exactly right. Because there's one part and two parts. And each of these are identical to each other, connected by this thing called the centromere. So that's a chromosome that you generally see depicted, and what you look at is generally a chromosome after DNA replication. And furthermore, this chromosome contains many genes, as you can see. And when you look even further, here's, you know, you're amplifying it tenfold, and now you're amplifying it another tenfold. There's gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, and gene 4. And now when you look at gene 1, it's quite big. And that gene has a very specific anatomy to it. It has a switch. It has these things called exons that specify proteins. And it has these things called introns, which you read about in discussion, which are between the exons in a given gene. So what I'm saying is that each of these genes have a beginning and an end, and they're discrete. And you know that they're discrete. You know that they're discrete because of the fact they can function independently of each other. And Shauna, you know that they can function independently of each other because you can take the glowfish gene and you can stick it in a pig and get it to glow green. That means that that glowfish gene works by itself. Right?
Right.
So it doesn't need anything else. So the anatomy of that gene is very specific. And I'm going to wrap this up in a few seconds. Is that clear? And so when you look at a chromosome, and now we're going down to different levels, you look at the chromosome, and you see there's the chromosome. That's all the genes after duplication. Here's the double helix. It's wound very specifically, and we'll talk more about this later. Here's the double helix, gene 1, gene 2, gene 3. They're called ORFs, open reading frame, because they can, the genetic code can be read in a very specific way. We have gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, mRNA 1, mRNA 2, mRNA 3, very specific sequences using the genetic code, protein 1, amino acid 1 and 2, protein 2, amino acid 1, 2, 3, protein 3, function 1, function 2, function 3. Specific gene, specific location, specific mRNA, specific sequence, specific protein, specific function, all working independently of each other. If you cloned this gene right here, and stuck it in another creature, you could get that creature to synthesize mRNA 2 and protein 2 and get a function for that protein, like insulin in bacteria. So if you isolated the insulin mRNA, as you know, not the gene, you could get it to function in a bacterial cell. Okay, now let me give you some dessert. And here's what I want you to know. It's Bob Goldberg's rendition of what a gene is. And you ain't going to hear it any other place but here. And you need to know this. So there's your gene, drawn out by me. It's a discrete part of a long DNA molecule. It's a discrete part of a chromosome. I'm just taking it out, but it's in a chromosome. It's continuous. Notice that there's a beginning and an end, but the gene is double-stranded. And notice what I've defined is a 5' end and a 3' end. And notice I've defined a sense strand and a transcribed strand. So let me go over this again. This is the anatomy of a gene. The gene is a discrete sequence of nucleotides on a chromosome. It has a beginning and it has an end. The gene has two DNA strands going in opposite direction, 5' to 3', and 3' to 5'. The gene has two strands. Only one strand dictates protein information. The strand that dictates protein information is called the sense strand. It makes genetic sense. The sense strand has the genetic code. The sense strand can be translated into the protein. And the sense strand is always 5' to 3' in the order of nucleotides. Okay? The opposite strand is not the sense strand. It's called sometimes the anti-sense strand. It's complementary to the sense strand. But that strand is very important. It's important because it's part of the double helix of DNA, but it's also important because that's the strand that's transcribed into RNA. And the RNA is always transcribed in an opposite polarity from its template, because the RNA, when it's transcribed, notice that that's a double helix. When the RNA is made off of its template, it's a double-stranded molecule. And that double-stranded molecule, even though one strand is RNA, and one strand is DNA, always obeys the same double helix rules, opposite polarity. And so now we have this strand going 3' to 5', and we have the RNA going 5' to 3', because any nucleic acid that is synthesized into a complementary nucleic acid, that complementary nucleic acid goes in opposite polarity because of the rules of the double helix. And that's why it's so important to understand the double helix. And so notice that the sequence of the sense strand is AGCTCGAAC, but notice the sequence of the mRNA is exactly the same. AGCU instead of T, because there's U in RNA instead of T in DNA, CGAAC. That's why this is the sense strand. That's the messenger RNA that has the genetic code. So the sense strand has exactly the same sequence as the messenger RNA. The antisense or transcribed strand goes in the opposite polarity and is complementary to the sense strand and complementary to the RNA in which it's the template for. So we have beginning and end, and the beginning is always defined by the 5' end of the sense strand. The end is always defined as the 3' end of the sense strand. But that's only where it begins. The genetic code is specific sequences. You know that they're triplets, and they're highly specific. If you know the genetic code, you can synthesize the gene for any protein. And here is the concept that I never want you to forget. Everything that's made up of a gene is modular. And because it's modular, you can engineer it. In other words, yo, everything is in the DNA sequence. The codon for alanine is a specific 3-nucleotide sequence. The codon for another amino acid is another specific nucleotides of 3-nucleotide sequence. And we know what they are. If you know what they are, you can synthesize genes in any order you want to make any protein you want. But it gets better than that. Lisa, this gene has a beginning. And in the beginning is this thing called the switch. And the switch is what turns the gene on and turns it off. The switch turns it off and turns it on. That's what that does with respect to making this RNA. The switch is right here. It's called the switch or promoter, but let's just call it a switch. And notice that it has very specific sequences, Lisa. TAT, AAT, 5 prime to 3 prime, ATA, TTA, 3 prime to 5 prime. That's a very specific sequence, isn't it? It's not random. The switch is specific. The beginning of the gene allows the enzyme that transcribes the gene to recognize what's the sense strand and what's the anti-sense strand. And the only way it can do that is with a very specific sequence. The enzyme that transcribes the gene recognizes this strand. Why? Because the sequence of this ATATTA is different than TATAAT. That is very profound. That means the beginning of genes can be identified in cells. And they're identified in cells by its sequence. And more than that, what strand of the gene should make the RNA can be identified in a cell because of the sequence. And the sequence is unique. And it's even more profound because if I isolate this sequence or switch, I can use it relative to anything else. Meaning, just as I can clone this part of the gene, I can clone that part of the gene and then start recombining the structural part of a gene which codes for the protein with a switch that turns it on and off. Is that clear? Sky, is that clear? They're discrete. Hold your question, Ben. I won't forget about you. They're discrete. And I'm being passionate about this because this is the basis of genetic engineering. There ain't any mystery here. Sommer, you want to synthesize a gene, come to my lab, and I'll let you synthesize a gene, and I'll be able to get you to synthesize a gene to be active anywhere you want. Because we know what many of these switches are. We know what the skin switch is. We know what the heart switch is. We know what the brain switch is in humans. We know what the leaf switch is, the root, the flower. We know all of this from experiments. And we know what these genes are. So if this switch was something that would be active in the mammary gland, as you know from your quiz, you could take it and put it next to something else. It's modular. If I wanted to synthesize a gene specifying any protein, I just use the genetic code and build it up 3 nucleotides at a time. And I make one chain, and then I make the chain that's complementary to it. I add the switch, and I can do anything I want. Okay, so now let me give you the take-home message here. If you know what these switches are, and if you know what the genes are, you can do almost anything. Because all of these things are built up in modular form. So you have a toolbox of modules. Sequence of the human genome has been done. There's a test tube that contains every one of your genes. I can promise you that. And they can be studied individually. Because we know the sequence of the genes, I'm not going to tell you how, we know from experiments many of what the switches are. Liver switches, heart switches, eye switches. We can get those from the sequence and put those in a little test tube. Now we have switches and we have genes. And we have splicing and synthesizing reactions that we can mix and match in any way we want. So now I'm going to show you how you create a new organism. Daisy, you asked a question a week or so ago, can you make wings? I forget exactly, maybe it was on a pig or a mouse or something like that. And I'm going to say that the answer to that is emphatically probably yes at some particular point in time. And I'm going to show you the precursor experiment. Because if you know the sequence of the genome, and if you know what genes dictate a wing, and if you know all the genes that specify the proteins in a wing, and if you know the order in which a wing comes together, and if you know all the switches, and if you engineer it all together, you can make a wing. And so now what I'm saying is that in the genome, there are networks. And yes, genes work independently of each other. Jessica? Genes also work under the control of other genes. In other words, what I'm saying is, yes, a gene can work independently, that some genes have to work because of the action of other genes. You don't have this because I stuck it in right before class. And so we have a gene that may be important in the formation of an eye. And that gene has a control switch which tells that eye gene to be active only in the part of an organism that becomes the eye, like in the head. So that switch says be only active in the head as it's developing in a specific place and nowhere else. And that gene will then produce a protein that interacts with the switches of all these other genes. And it will turn on all of those other genes in a specific sequence of events to make proteins that go into making an eye. And those proteins are all necessary for making an eye. And what happens if you decide to change the switch? What do you think? What do you think would happen if you changed the switch, Becca? By engineering. The switch of this eye control gene. What if I engineered a different switch? Let's say I wanted an eye on a leg.
You can make it so that
you can use a switch that's active in a leg and make it be expressed there.
And what would you get?
An eye on a leg.
You think that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to show you that that's old technology. It was done 10 years ago. There's a fruit fly. It has an eye on its head. Not a good picture, but there's the eye of the fruit fly, and it's on its head. The reason why the eye of the fruit fly is on its head is because there's this gene that controls the formation of other genes, the activity of other genes, that are necessary to make an eye. And that gene is activated when the head forms of the fly, and would you say, Josh, in a very specific place of the eye. Well, that gene's been isolated. And that gene has a switch. And that switch can be engineered. And furthermore, genes have been isolated that are active only on the leg of a fly. Would you say that there's genes that are active on legs of flies, Sky? They'd be different than the ones on the head, wouldn't they? Because it's a leg different than a head. And they have switches, right? Well, what if I take those leg switches and I put them next to that eye control gene? So now the switch of the leg is hooked up to this eye gene that turns on all the other genes that are going to make an eye. You think I can make an eye on a leg? What do you think? What do you think?
Yes.
Well, there, well, turn it around. There's your leg of the fly, and there's your eye. Did you ever see a fly with an eye on a leg? You know, flies have antennas. Patricia, antennas have genes. Antenna genes have switches. You think I can make an eye on an antenna by engineering? Well, I think you're right, because there's a head of a fly that has four eyes. There's the normal ones, and now the antenna has been turned into eyes. You're engineering different forms of organisms. All I'm doing is changing a switch. I haven't really done anything dramatic here. I'm just changing a switch. All I'm doing in this particular series of experiments, something very simple. I'm taking this eye gene, which is a control gene, and I'm taking this eye gene. There's the eye gene. This gene makes an RNA and a protein that switches on other genes, because the protein that's made by this RNA interacts with the switch of the other genes, and it's those genes that make the eye. But now I'm taking the switch that functions on a gene in the antenna. I'm splicing it by genetic engineering, much like you do on your quizzes, to that eye structural gene, and I'm sticking it back in the fly. And now that gene thinks that it should be active in the antenna. and it turns on genes in the antenna that would never be turned on because the genes in the antenna don't have I switches that are activated. But now it's activated. It's activated by the antenna genes, and we get an I. Isn't that amazing? So we're engineering new forms of organisms. And so we're way beyond this business of taking the insulin gene. We're way beyond taking the insulin gene and sticking it in to a bacteria. We are way beyond that. We're getting to the heart of the matter. We're getting to the fact that we're understanding the human genome. We're getting to the fact that we're understanding what genes control the formation of your eyes, your nose, your legs, your liver, your heart, and everything. I hate to tell you this. I know it may shatter a lot of your preconceptions, but it's all in the sequence of your DNA. And if you know what that sequence is, and if you know what the modules are that control these things, you can duplicate it at some point. We can't duplicate it now because it's too complicated, but we will. And that leads to some really profound issues, because I just showed you that you can change the architecture of a fly. Now, those eyes don't work. The reason they don't work is eyes only work when they're connected by neurons to the brain, and there's no neurons in the leg that can connect it to the brain, so the eye isn't working, but theoretically you might be able to get it to work. So what I'm saying here is that everything becomes possible. And what I'm trying to tell you here is that it only is possible because of adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, and the order in which they're in. And it's only possible because the order in which they are in is very specific. And if you know the order, you know the function. If you know the function and you can use genetic engineering, you can make modules of anything. If you can make modules of anything, you can make your own gene combinations. I've just shown you some new combinations that lead to a new fly. Eyes where they're not supposed to be. So I know it's far-fetched, and I know we would probably never want to do something like this in humans or maybe any other creature. But I don't know, why not? It's going to be for you guys to decide. And theoretically, some of these things are possible. And the question then becomes, how far should we go? Should we say there's a ban on any of these things? Should we say we should stop studying the human genome because it may lead to the finding of a heart switch, which means we could engineer someone with two hearts instead of one? Should we stop this research because maybe 1,000 or 10,000 years from now we'll be able to make new human life forms that have four arms and four legs and five eyes and all kinds of other things? But that's where it goes, because I'm not suggesting that we do this, quite the contrary. What I'm suggesting is that you're dealing with a closed system. The human genome is not infinitely open. You're dealing with a gene which is unique, a body in a switch, you're dealing with a genetic code that's specific, you're dealing with sequences that we know, you're dealing with processes that we're beginning to understand, and you're dealing with, at some point in time, I cannot predict when it will be, we will have knowledge of every single process of biology that you could ever imagine. And when you know that, you can use technology that's now 30 years old, genetic engineering technology. It's older than you guys, in order to do this. The engineering that was used to do this can be done in a high school laboratory. The key is to know what sequences you're engineering. That's the key. And that's what we learned from all of these human genome projects. This experiment was done in 1995. Imagine all the information we have now between 1995 and now. And it's also interesting that that I gene in the fly ain't that different from the I gene that makes your eyes. So now we know that too, that the genes that make eyes in flies aren't different from the genes that make eyes in you. Okay, I'm going to break it now, but we're going to do one last experiment for the quarter before you leave. And that one last experiment is to be a DNA fingerprint of you, which we will give you on Tuesday. And so just let me tell you a little bit about what we're doing. And Gloria and Mike are going to hand you some stuff. And I want you to be very careful when you do this stuff because we want to get a very specific profile. So just follow me and don't worry about them, okay? Just listen to me. What we're going to do is to, just hold off for a sec. What we're going to do is make a DNA fingerprint of you. And what we're going to do is assemble all of the DNA fingerprints from all of you in this class. You're going to see all of you together. And it's going to serve two purposes. One, you're going to find your own genotype. And two, you're going to see the genotype of everybody else. And you're going to see at the DNA level why you all look different, so to speak. Because you're going to actually see the genetic diversity that we've been talking about at the DNA level. And what you're doing in this class is no different than what you'd be doing if you were, Matt, asked to take a DNA test. Of course, you don't have to take a DNA test, as you'll learn. In order to take a DNA test, someone has to give you a search warrant because, you know, there's something called the 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment to the Constitution and the 4th Amendment. You know, you're protected against unreasonable searches and seizures. And your cells are part of you, and you don't have to give them up unless someone gives you a search warrant. But once they give you a search warrant, you don't have a choice. So what you're going to be doing is you're going to be taking a cotton swab, and you're going to be taking a couple cheek cells, and you're going to be putting them in something, and then we're going to use something that I'll talk to you about next week called the polymerase chain reaction, and we're going to use that to amplify directly from your chromosomes a specific DNA region. It's not a gene region. It's a specific DNA region, and then you'll be able to see it. And on your take-home test that you're going to get on Tuesday, there'll be a big question about all of your DNA fingerprints and what it means. And so you can actually analyze your own data. We're not going to analyze it for you. You're going to analyze it. But it's a lot of fun. So here's the caution. If you want this to work, who's going to do this? Gavino or Gloria or... Brandon, who's going to be calling it out? Okay. I want you to follow what Gloria says. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and do it as accurately and as best you can because we're talking about many, many, many hours in the laboratory after you give us your samples, and we want it to work. So be as careful as you can be in what we're going to tell you to do, and it should only take about 5 minutes. So the first thing is that we're going to distribute water to all of you, and then we're going to distribute a DNA testing kit, which we've purchased for each of you. What are they going to be spitting into? Where's your microphone? I want you to shout this out, Gloria. Okay, get these bottles. Get your DNA testing kit.
All right. Where's my model?
Step number one. They haven't put their name on it.
My model. All right.
Give them pens.
So, does everybody have a pen? Any pen? The first thing you're going to do is you're going to write your name in legible handwriting, please, on this little tube we have here.
Your full name. First
yes,
and
full
last.
Name. And date is optional.
And in fact, write it in a couple places.
Sure. A few times. Just write it everywhere. Just go nuts.
Jessica, where are those 18,000 pens that you made me buy for the class? At $5 each. Mm-hmm. Does everyone have a pen? Pencil?
Everybody good?
And if you guys who are filming could hone in, zoom in on what they're doing, I would appreciate it so it's on film.
Zoom in on the
get it at the highest magnification. and then zoom out so we can use it for a project. Brandon, can you check the clips?
Okay. Now the next thing you're going to do is you're going to take these adorable little bottles of water and you're going to open them.
Wait. Has everyone written their name in two places? Okay.
Oh, then
step
do it.
Step number two.
Then do it if you haven't written it in two places.
Step number two.
Smile open your bottle
Jessica,
of water.
She's taking pictures.
And take a nice big gulp and swish it around in your mouth. Swish it around like you're trying to wash out all those yucky
Clean
things in your mouth.
Clean all that crap out of your mouth.
Yeah, do it. Swish, swish, swish. Swish, swish. You're swishing? Good.
I went to the dentist the other day, and my dentist said that he had worked on someone who hadn't brushed his teeth in a decade.
Ew.
Man, that must have been fun.
Yeah. I have a friend who hasn't gone to the dentist in like 9 years or something.
Yeah, that's right. You get near him?
Wow.
Okay, swish it around again a second time.
Don't forget to swallow because there's nowhere to spit, so you got to swallow, okay?
Let's go. Now imagine while you do this, someone served you with a search warrant to require you to do this. So pretend that there's someone like Officer Harry Klan or somebody else that says, we want to do a DNA fingerprint of you because you're a suspect in something, and here's your search warrant. Give us a sample. This is exactly what you're going to be doing. That brings a little bit of reality to it. Step number three.
So the next step is to take your little kit here, and you're going to break the seal. Watch what Mike's doing.
Wait.
We're waiting. Going to watch what Mike's doing first. Twist it. Twist the cap, the top part. You see? Does everybody see? Anybody have any questions?
Do it again.
We're going to do it again. Tomo's going to demonstrate. This is Tomo, everybody, in case you don't know. Oh, do you see that? Excellent. Okay. Now you're going to...
Everyone twisted it? Go. Don't open it.
Everybody twist. Is it twisted? Yeah? Okay, now you're going to... Now you can open it. Watch, Mike.
Don't stick your fingers on it.
Just take off the cap. Okay.
Just watch Tomo and watch Mike.
Tomo's got to swish first. You're going to swish first? Okay. So watch them. You're going to take out this little swab here. And not yet. Just watch them. And then you're going to swab the insides of one cheek 20 times and the other cheek 20 times. Now make sure you get all of your cheeks. So you want to get as many cells as possible on the swab. Okay, so watch
Mike and watch Tomo and then do it.
Watch how they do it. So he's counting 1, 2, 3, 4. Just get the whole cheek. Get it nice and good.
Because we need as many cells as we can get to get a good DNA profile. So it's like you're brushing your teeth
on
the
other side.
Okay? And wait, before you do it, what's the next step?
And the next step, you take it out and you put it back in. Make sure you put it back in the same way you took it out. So make sure the part of the swab that you put in your mouth is on the bottom. And then you recap it. Just like that.
Okay, go to town. Okay. Pretty neat, isn't it?
20 times, either cheek.
Let's go, Matt.
Get it nice and good.
Go, Ben. Go, T. Come on. Come on, Lisa, Betty, Karina. Wouldn't that be fun if someone was handing you a search warrant? Wouldn't that be incredible, huh? No, I don't think so. I wouldn't want that to happen. Nor would I want it to happen to you guys. Put it in. Stick it in. Stick it way in. Got it, Chris? Put it in. Don't leave it around because
20 times each
you'll
cheek.
Contaminate it. We don't want any bacteria or fungi on that thing.
Cap it. Yep.
Make sure your name is on it loud and clear because you're going to have to do what you're going to have to analyze your own genotype. If your name's not on it, we don't know which one's which. So if you're unsure, write it on there a third time. We don't want it to come off.
Okay. So we'll come around and collect them.
Make sure your name's on there at least twice, maybe three times. Does anyone have any questions about what you just did? Matt, you understand? Nick? You'll get it back.
But you didn't have a search warrant, so I'm giving you my...
You don't have to if you don't want to. You can opt out. It's all voluntary. Okay, any questions? Just a sec. Just a sec. Anton? Matt? Jordan? Hannah? So, Matt, describe what you just did. Where's your microphone? Got it.
I just swabbed each side of my
cheek. And what were the cells that you were swabbing?
The tissue cells in my mouth, or the...
And where's the DNA in those cells?
It's in the chromosomes.
And where are the chromosomes located in those cells?
The nucleus.
So what are we going to have to do to get the DNA out of those cells?
We're going to have to somehow extract them from the nucleus.
We're going to have to break the cell?
Yeah.
We'll have to break the nucleus?
Yeah.
And we'll have to do something kind of like what you did the first week to get the DNA out?
Yeah.
And then we're going to fingerprint using a very specific part of your chromosomes, of which you all have the same part. It's not a gene, but we're going to do it by a very different process that you'll read about for discussion tomorrow. But you're going to be very surprised when you see the results. It's going to be very interesting. Would you predict, T, that you all have the same results?
No.
Can you give T the microphone? What would you predict?
That we would have different results.
And would you predict that each individual might have one DNA band or two DNA bands? I'm not telling you what those bands are, but...
Okay.
How many? What would be the maximum number of DNA... If we were analyzing a gene, what would be the maximum number, let's say, different gene bands we'd be able to see in an individual?
The max?
Yeah, the maximum.
Like a lot?
No. We're analyzing one gene.
Oh, okay.
How many different forms of that gene might there be in an individual?
One.
Possibly. What's another possibility, Patricia?
Two, three.
Three in a single individual?
I don't know. Okay.
We have a two. Given gene. What are different forms of the same gene called? Alleles.
Alleles.
How many alleles can there be in an individual at most?
Oh, two.
Exactly. So how many, if we said that each band that we were able to analyze for you represented one gene, how many different bands might you be able to see at most in your chromosome, in your cells
two.
For this gene?
Two.
Okay. And if each of these little alleles was identified by their size of DNA on a gel, you might be able to see two of two different sizes.
Correct.
From you, or maybe one if you're homozygous or heterozygous. And how many in the population as a whole?
Still two.
In the whole population? What do you think? Two? How many? Shauna? As many as it can be as people in the room. Can't predict, but there will be scores. I can promise you it'll be more than two. So that's what you'll see when you see your gel on Tuesday. That's what we're doing. We're looking at the genotype of a specific gene, and we're looking at it in individuals and in the population. Come prepared with your case read on Thursday. Be prepared for the discussion tomorrow. I'll see you tomorrow. I will be in your discussions tomorrow. See you then. Yeah, don't forget to miss these handouts. Get them. Get the handouts. If you haven't turned in your double helix essay, please do now. Or forever hold your peace.